listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is sponsored by Fairway, like no other market. Welcome to Why We Cook on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm Erica Wides, your host. I'm a chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education in Manhattan. And so tonight I want to talk about a couple things. Well, you'll figure it out as we go. But I want to start with talking about my Netflix account. So I have this Netflix account that kind of suffers from neglect. My movie watching at home goes in phases. And sometimes I'll get DVDs from Netflix, and then they'll sit around my apartment for 2-3 months before I actually get around to watching them. It's kind of stupid. I think it's a big waste of money, and I'm probably going to cancel. But the last two movies that I got were delivered in October, mid-October, and I just mailed them back yesterday. Doesn't seem really useful to me. But it's all kind of dependent on how my weekends are spent. So if it's the summer and we're up in the country, then we watch them because we have no other entertainment up there. But if it's the winter, especially around this time of year, I'm working nights and weekends and all the time. So the movies have to wait for me. But this weekend, I finally watched my October movies. And one of them was a movie I hadn't seen in 22 years. So back in 1987, when I was in college studying art and photography, I saw a lot of independent films. And that was the year that Babette's Feast came out. And I'm sure a lot of you have seen it and remember it. But if you don't remember what it's about these two sisters who live in northern Denmark in the mid-1800s in Jutland, which is way up in the north. And these two sisters they live with their father, who's a widow, and they're very devoted to their father. He's a priest and a religious zealot, and he has his own following, and they're very, very devoted to him, so much so that they turn away suitors and when they're young and beautiful. And after his death, they grow old together as spinsters, basically. Not a word I love, but that's what they were. And they live this very stark northern Scandinavian kind of life, eating dried salted cod and soup that they make from dried up bread and ale that looked like puke, and praying and worshiping to their dead father. And they have this ever shrinking group of other devotees who are steadily dying off as they get older. It's very grim, dark stuff, very Bergman-esque, as we would have said back in art school. But one day, Babette arrives, and she comes to them from France, post-revolutionary France, which, watch the movie, you'll see why. And she becomes their housekeeper. And she learns their kind of stifling, repressed ways and cooks them their very dull, pleasureless food, despite her inclinations. And this goes on for about 14 years. And then, through a series of events, we find out the truth about Babette, and that is that she was at one time the most famous chef in Paris, the most famous or only woman chef in Paris. But she had to leave. And her only link to France still is this lottery ticket that she resubscribes to yearly. She has a friend who in Paris who resubscribes the lottery ticket. So, of course, wouldn't you know it, one day Babette wins the lottery. And she wins 10,000 francs. And she decides that she's going to spend those 10,000 francs to cook a once-in-a-lifetime dinner to honor the 100th birthday of the dead father of the sisters, because she's very grateful to them. So the sisters are excited about it, but they're kind of wary because she's French and they're exotic and sensual and they're Danish and not. And these crates start to arrive from France of wine and food and supplies, and it's all very erotic and strange and exotic. And having been sustained on bread and ale soup and dried cod for many decades, they're terrified of pleasure, basically. They lived their lives deprived of pleasure, and they've never tasted any form of sensuality, and this represents this very threatening meal. But Babette preps and gets ready and does all this preparation, and she cooks this incredible 5-course meal with wine for the sisters and their group of aging, repressed religious zealots. And the meal, of course, is like nothing they've ever experienced, nothing they've ever tasted. And, you know, they slowly get totally loaded at this dinner and loosen up and have the meal of their lives and rediscover or finally discover, you know, their sensual sides and pleasure. And anyway, I won't get into the details of what she cooked, but watching it is an education in seriously old school classical French cuisine of the era, which is kind of cool in itself. The film is really beautifully made and the food parts of it are fantastic. And the pleasure that she derives from cooking this meal and the pleasure that these old Danish people receive from eating it is really, really visceral and tactile. And it's beautiful and it's totally worth watching again if you hadn't seen it in 22 years like me. And I actually heard that up at the CIA, the Culinary Institute, they used to show it to all their incoming students to inspire them, which seems like a great thing to do. So Babette served the guests the best meal of their lives. And it was a meal that was like the equivalent of like stepping into an Italian Renaissance era cathedral, you know, all gold and frescoes and ornamentation, after living in pious Nordic utilitarian gray world. And the contrast is what was, you know, so spectacular in the movie. And it got me thinking about meals that I've had, meals that made a difference in my life or were turning points for me in my, you know, my evolution as an eater and as a chef. You know, those light bulb moments in food where I went, oh, that's what it's about. That's what it all means. And I was trying to remember like what I thought of as, you know, some of the best meals of my life, but it's too hard to really say definitively. There've been kind of specific things I've eaten or courses I've eaten that have been great or transcendent, but it's hard to sum it up as the best meal I've ever had. However, when I really started to think about this, what really has stuck with me was the worst meals I've ever had. And it's hard to say there, too, which the worst meal was I ever had, because, you know, you teaching, you're, you know, presented with like a huge range of people with varying levels of skill, and they all need you to taste their food. And I knew that somewhere in there, I was trying to think back to what was the pinnacle of horribleness that I've ever encountered in my eating life. Was it while I was teaching? Was it somewhere else? And I knew there was one there, and I couldn't remember it. It was like right there in my memory, but I couldn't put my finger on it. There were parts of it that came back to me, but I couldn't conjure up the whole thing. And then a few days ago, it all came back to me. Now, before I get to that, to the worst plate that was ever presented to me, I have to say that I have eaten some pretty bad food in my lifetime, like I'm sure we all have. I went to public school in the U.S. in the 70s and 80s. I've traveled in the Midwest. I went to the Czech Republic right after the wall came down. Those were all seriously low points in the eating history of my life. But about 2 years ago, there was a practical exam plate that was presented to me that hit the lowest of the low notes of cooking ability ever experienced by this 13-year veteran of culinary education. We'll get to that in a minute. We have to take a short break. We'll be right back on Why We Cook. Listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Our show tonight is sponsored by Fairway, like no other market. Welcome back to Why We Cook on heritageradionetwork.com. I'm Erica Wise, your host for the evening. If you are a fan of Why We Cook, you can find us on Facebook at Why We Cook at Heritage Radio Network. Become a fan, send me a message. I'd love to hear from you. You can also listen to heritageradionetwork.com programming 24 hours a day now at heritageradionetwork.com, or you can podcast us on iTunes now also. So you can have Heritage Radio Network programming in several easy, convenient formats brought to you. Okay, so what I'm talking about tonight is the lowest of the low, the worst food I've ever eaten, the worst food I've ever been served. It was not in public school in the 70s. It was not somewhere in the Midwest. It was not in the Czech Republic at the end of communism. It was at the school where I teach, and I've been teaching there for almost 13 years now. Now, in the program that I teach in, our culinary curriculum is divided up into five modules. Each module ends with a practical exam, kind of like the compulsories at the Olympics, and you know, where the students have to cook and present specific items or dishes within an allotted time frame. And in the final module, mod five, however, the exam is a little bit different. It's the dreaded creative practical. It's not dreaded by the students. They love it. It's dreaded by the instructors because we don't like to let them be creative. Now, these students at this point have been there for about 6 to 8 months or so, and some of them have come really, really far and are great, and some of them are totally hopeless. And giving them a chance to be creative is a huge crapshoot. It's a huge gamble because some of them may not even have developed enough skill level to cook the basics. Like, they may not even really get it yet at this point, unfortunately, despite our best efforts. And, you know, and some of them can't even really think outside of that little box that we like to lock them into and throw away the key. So we kind of dread the practical, the creative practical. Now, there are students there who have very high skill level. They have a lot of worldly experience. Some of them have eaten at more, you know, Michelin starred, Zagat reviewed restaurants than I've ever been to. And they really get it. And they can kind of reinterpret their experiences on the plate. And that's what we're looking for. But then there are the students who think that the Cheesecake Factory is as great as great food gets. And the ones who think that are the ones who tend to have problems with the creative practical. They're the ones for whom interning at the Penn Station Deli seems like a good choice. And that's true. I kid you not. I had a student who did his internship at the Penn Deli in Penn Station. Anyway, back to the worst plate. So a couple days ago, I was teaching and an old student came to visit. This happens a lot. They pop in, they say hello. It's a nice kid. Thai family, comes from Thailand. He did his internship at a really good restaurant. Now he's heading off to Bangkok for a job. And that's great. He came around to drop off some of his final paperwork and to say hello, and nice to see him. And when he came in and when I saw him, it all suddenly came rushing back to me. Like in the movies where it all just like right back to you. Like a wave of nausea from a parasite you picked up in India and never really got rid of. Sometimes you feel okay and you think you're over it, and then sometimes you realize you're not. He was from this class a few years ago, the class that brought the wave of nausea back to me. He was a good student. He wasn't the problem. But he was from this class that had the kid who gave me the worst plate ever. And having this kid come and visit me brought it all back to me. The worst plate I'd ever eaten. So the kid who gave me the worst plate, he was young. I think he was under 20. And he was one of those kids that was born late to affluent baby boomer parents who had him, you know, kind of near the end of their childbearing years. And they're from the never criticize, never say no school of parenting. The self-esteem generation, I like to call these kids, the products of a parenting philosophy that is now backfiring as these kids of boomers go to college and we teachers have to pick up the pieces from them never being told no or never being criticized. And I'm not sure if it's just the way that this kid's face was constructed, but he always seemed to be smirking. He had kind of this perpetual little smirk on his face, this little wry smile that gave him a look that said, I don't really care what you think or say because my mom told me everything I do is great. So there. And he had also apparently been either like a child model or a child actor or something like that. So that added a whole other level of grossly warped self-esteem slash bizarre insecurity to the mixture. So this kid, I won't say his name, said his father was going to be buying him a restaurant in Mexico, in some town, I think like Acapulco, like some really kind of old school touristy resorty, you know, horrible town to begin with. I think it was Acapulco. And he had also taken our culinary management program. So he seemed to think that at 20 years old, he was ripe and ready for entrepreneurship, ready to go. And I thought, well, that serves those tourists right for choosing to go to a place like Acapulco, because now they're going to be punished by eating this kid's food. So the creative practical exam was coming up. I had his class for the last mod. And the creative practical exam happens sort of like this. The instructor chooses a protein. Usually we do a whole chicken, but sometimes we like to mix it up a little bit for a challenge. And there's this big long list also of vegetables and grains and starches and staples that get delivered to the classroom also, along with that chosen protein. And the students get to create something from that. And it varies a little bit between instructors, but it basically breaks down like this. Students are given 90 minutes, and in that time, they have to properly fabricate their protein, correctly cook it, which means if it's red meat, medium rare, if it's poultry, till it's done but not dry, if it's fish, perfectly opaque in the center but not overdone. You get the idea. Perfectly cook the protein, make an appropriate sauce, cook a vegetable and a starch to accompany it, and present it at exactly the assigned time. I take points off for being late, and I take points off for being early, because basically we're playing restaurant. And if their presentation time is 3 o'clock, it's because that's when the customer wants the plate. They don't want it brought out early and they don't want it brought out late. So it's good training for them. So this time around in his class, I was tired of eating all this overdone and undercooked chicken that I'm always presented. So I decided to change things up. I was going to pick another protein. And I'd done other things before. I did whole ducks. I've done lamb racks, pork tenderloins, lobster. This class I decided was going to do fish. We get these farmed hybrid striped bass at work. And I don't love them. They taste a little bit like mildew. They taste a little basement-y to me, but they're cheap and they're not too bad. I'm not a big fan of farmed fish, but these are okay. But I wanted this class to deal with fabricating the fish. I kind of didn't love this class overall to begin with, and I think I was feeling a little bit sadistic. So I wanted them to have to fabricate the fish. Plus the challenge of making a sauce to go with the fish was really going to mess with them. So yeah, I was feeling a little sadistic. There were a couple of people in the class that were great, who I love, who I'm still in touch with. And if you're listening tonight, you know who you are. This has nothing to do with you. You know who I'm talking about. So they had 90 minutes to fabricate the fish, cook it, make a sauce, and pair it with a cooked veg and a cooked starch. Simple. I assigned presentation times. I gave them their basic rules. I handed out a staples list. I got my fork ready, my pitcher of water ready, my garbage can for potentially spitting things out in ready, and I was ready to go. When we come back from our break, I'll talk about what happened. We'll be right back on Why We Cook. You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Our show tonight is sponsored by Fairway, like no other market. Welcome back to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Erica Wides, your host. And tonight I am telling you the story of the worst plate ever. The worst food I have ever been served in my culinary career. So in the last segment, I was talking about this practical exam that I had to give and laying out the rules for that and talking about this unnamed student I once had, who I call Smirkface, who gave me the worst food I've ever eaten. So we left off. I had assigned their presentation times. Everybody was ready to go. They had their whole fish. They were ready to serve. So I can't remember where in the order of presentation he was, but I can tell you that I don't remember a single other plate that was given to me that day because they all paled in comparison. When it was his time to present, he brought the plate up to my little tasting table at the front of the classroom. And the way these kitchens are set up, we have these little tables where we can kind of set ourselves up in the front of the room. And the smarter students figure out right away that they should set up their cutting boards on the tables that are closest to where I am so they can listen to my commentary as their classmates present their plates. And then they can always adjust their plates on the fly based on what I said. That's what the smart students do. He was not one of the smart students. So he hands me the plate, and I look down at the plate. And it had a fillet of the hybrid striped bass. He was able to fillet the fish. The skin had been left on the fillet, which normally is fine. I love crispy fish skin. If you saute a piece of fish properly with the skin on, that's my favorite part. And my students know I love fish skin, and I teach them to properly cook the fish with the skin on. But his fish not only had the skin on, it also had the scales on it. The fillet had been kind of folded in half, like a piece of paper, sort of in half. And in between the halves of the fish was this pool of melted Gruyere cheese that was dripping down the sides where the two halves were sealed together by the melted cheese. He had taken this piece of fish, put the cheese in it, folded it in half, put it on a, we call them sizzle platters. It's like a piece of metal you cook on, and put it in the oven. No oil on it, no seasoning, nothing. He baked it for a really long time. And the skin was drying up and shrinking off of the fillet. And because of that, the scales stood erect on the crisp skin. They had been pulled upright as the skin tightened and retracted from the desiccation that had occurred in the probably 20 to 30 minutes too long that the fish had spent in the oven. It was like when you see those old recreations of dinosaurs and they have those plates standing up along their backs that were the precursors to scales. It was like that. Now, on the plate accompanying the fish was a carrot that he had torneed. Now, torneing is a classical French style of cutting vegetables where you cut the vegetable into sort of a seven-sided football, seven equal size, elongated football shaped. This tournée looked like it had been cut with a spoon. We make our students tournée for days and days and days early in the program because it helps them to fine-tune their knife skills and it gives them really good kind of hand-eye coordination. He apparently had forgotten how to do that. The carrot tournée was completely coated in caramel. Not like a glaze, like a glazed vegetable, but caramel. Hard, brown, solid sugar caramel. And there was also a strip of red pepper that had been so unfortunate as to get caught up in the caramel crime scene also and was basically disintegrating into it because it was so soft. There was a potato somewhere in the equation too, but it's escaped my memory now, overshadowed by the atrocities that were presented to me. And because I require a sauce on the plate, there was also a decorative drizzle of the same hardened brown caramelized sugar dripped over the cheese-coated fish, or the cheese-filled fish, I should say, and onto the plate. So he laid this plate down in front of me, and I, for the first time in my life, was speechless. I couldn't even begin to dissect what was wrong with the plate. in a way that I would be able to even communicate it to him. I couldn't get even close to tasting it. I was so disgusted by it. So I looked up at him and he had his typical pleased smirk on his face. He looked pretty happy with himself. And I just said, "What is this?" And he said, "Well, my family was eating at Red Lobster and my sister had salmon that had Parmesan cheese stuffed all over it or melted all over it. And I thought it was great. So since we only had Gruyere cheese to use, I wanted to recreate it and I did it this way." I told him that despite what he may have picked up from his culinary experience at Red Lobster, there was no way I was going to taste his fish since it was covered in scales. Then I peeled a few of them off, handed them to him, and made him eat them. "Is that pleasant?" I asked him. "No," he said, still smirking. "Do you think a customer would enjoy eating those?" I asked him. He didn't answer. "Have we ever cooked fish with melted cheese in between it or baked it dry and unscaled in the oven?" I asked. "I thought it was good," he said. "I can't even comment on that," I said. I am without comment. I decided to move on from the fish. "Okay, then, what's up with all the caramel on the plate?" I asked him. "I wanted to glaze the vegetables," he said. And I said, "Do you remember how back in Mod 2 we learned how to glaze vegetables?" And he said, "Yeah, you glaze them with sugar." And I said, "What else?" "I can't remember," he said. I said, "If you couldn't remember, why did you do it?" And he said, "Well, I knew there was sugar in there somewhere." I said, "Well, what about butter or chicken stock or water or some other kind of liquid and simmering the carrots until they're actually cooked and then creating the glaze? Does any of this sound familiar?" He just looked at me like I was the idiot. So I cut into the carrot and it was raw inside. And on the surface, the caramel shattered into shards and flew all over the plate. "And the hard burnt drizzle of caramel on the plate, what's that for?" I asked him. "Well, you said we needed a sauce. So that's my sauce." I sat there in silence for at least a minute. I was truly without speech. I didn't even know how to process the moment. And for a few brief seconds, I actually doubted myself. Maybe I had failed him. Maybe it was my teaching. Maybe it was my fault. It wasn't his utter lack of a clue. But then a piece of caramel hit me in the face. I snapped back to reality. No, it wasn't my fault. It was him. I handed the plate back to him, untasted and untouched, except for the shattered carrot and the remains of the scales that I had made him eat that he had then spit out. This is the last day of the last mod of culinary school. You're graduating this week, and this is what you present to me? In 12 years of teaching, this is by far the worst plate of food I have ever been given. And in 38, 9 odd years of life, this is the worst food I have ever eaten in all my time on this planet. He just walked away, strangely unharmed by my criticism, indifferent even. He failed the practical, but he graduated from school anyway, because that's how we do it. The last I had heard, he had opened his place in Acapulco. Tourists, beware. Thanks for joining us tonight on Why We Cook. We'll see you next week. Have a great holiday, and thanks for listening.